Welcome back to our Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis, and with us today we have Beth Sturman, Executive Director of Laurel House, and Leslie Slingsby, who is the Executive Director of Mission Kids Child Advocacy Center. And ladies, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
We are sitting down in October, which is National Domestic Abuse Awareness Month, and we're going to talk today, though, about, I think, more on the effect of on children and child abuse today. So let's start off with Beth first, and then Leslie, tell us about your organization, and then we'll start our conversation.
Sure. Thank you, Laura. Laurel House is a comprehensive domestic violence agency. We serve all of Montgomery County, and we work with the entire family. We work with the non-offending parent. We work with the children that are directly impacted by witnessing or being exposed to domestic violence. And we work with any other family members and friends who have also been impacted by the abuse that the primary person is going through.
And Leslie?
At Mission Kids, its goal is achieving healing and justice for all child abuse victims. And we do that by reducing trauma with having a multidisciplinary team approach to responding to any child abuse allegations in Montgomery County. So we ensure that there's kind of a medical professional responding, a therapist, a victim advocate, a forensic interviewer, law enforcement, child protective services, and the district attorney. So the child would actually have to come to one place for services instead of all of those different professionals responding and interviewing that child.
Okay. So, Beth, you already alluded to this about the family. Is child abuse like a natural outcome of this? Or what are the effects on the entire family when there is abuse present?
Sure. So what we see, sometimes the children, if one of the adults in the household is being abused by the other adult. Sometimes the children are also being physically abused. What we see more often is the children are so traumatized by being exposed to the abuse. Oftentimes the adults think the kids don't know what's happening because the kids are asleep or the kids are out of the home at the time the abuse is actually taking place. But the kids know what's going on, and the kids are directly affected. It shows up in all different kinds of ways in their social interaction, in their schoolwork, and in the ways that they respond to both parents.
And Leslie, is that what you find?
Yeah, it's absolutely what we find. There's actually research would show about 30 to 60% of domestic violence cases also have children who are also experiencing physical abuse. So it's not only the domestic violence itself impacts children, but there's a higher likelihood that they also could be experiencing abuse themselves.
Well, let's talk about abuse to begin with, and what constitutes abuse. And I'm talking about domestic and child here.
That's a great question, because people often think, and even people who are living in an abusive relationship often think, well, this isn't domestic violence. This isn't domestic abuse because I haven't had any broken bones. I haven't been punched or hit. But there's all different kinds of emotional, financial, sexual, as well as physical abuse. A lot of power and control is what domestic violence is all about and domestic abuse is all about. So it's really one person in the relationship trying to gain and maintain control over the actions and behavior of the other person.
Well, describe some of that control there, too.
So it typically starts off subtle. It starts off with things like, oh, honey, do we really need to, go to your family's this weekend? Can't it just be the two of us? It sounds very romantic. I really just love it when we have time alone. And then over time, what happens is the person who's being abused is so isolated from his or her family, friends, natural support system. So what started out looking like a romantic gesture, a romantic interest in just having some alone time, turns into really cutting that person off from all of the other people that might be supportive in their circle.
And it also financial control, et cetera.
We have worked with families, even families from, high-income families, where the one person who's being abused has no access to the bank account, doesn't know the passwords to log on and look at financial statements, isn't permitted to know anything about the financial situation of the family. So there's a lot of control that way. Very limited budget for maybe for the grocery money. If the budget's exceeded, there's a consequence. Those kinds of really, even with typically where we see this more is with women who are the victims, but even with women who have high net worth jobs themselves, we often see that they don't have access to their own money that they've earned.
Leslie, what about child abuse? What constitutes abuse when you're talking about a parental or guardian and a child.
Sure. So it was certainly different definitions regarding the Child Protective Services Law as well as the criminal code, but certainly any there's a variety of different types. One is physical abuse. And so that is certainly, you know, using kind of extreme measures, you know, further than corporate punishment to discipline the child or, you know, embarrass the child, depends on the circumstances, as well as sexual abuse or sexual exploitation of children, as well as serious neglect issues for children are also in relation to kind of the definition of child abuse. So we're kind of looking at those things about what meets the definition of child physical abuse, sexual abuse, or serious neglect under those different guidelines.
Well, and here's a term that you used, co-occurrence of domestic violence and child abuse. So we've got a home that has a malignant relationship to begin with. Talk amongst yourselves, but tell me, what's the average family look like and how does it function if you have abuse of either kind in the household?
Average would be hard to come by because every case that we work with, every situation we work with, there are some commonalities, but every case is pretty unique. What we see a lot is, again, that isolation, whether the kids are directly being abused or whether they have that secondary trauma, but the isolation, not allowing other people from the family, not allowing other caretakers into the home. A lot of warnings to the children about not sharing what's going on in the home with people outside. Sometimes direct threats. If you tell, you know, your teacher, if you tell your grandmom what's going on, you'll be taken away. You'll be put in a foster home. So a lot of very cloistered kind of family relationships. So that it takes oftentimes what we see, and I know Leslie sees this too, that sometimes those first meeting or the first couple of meetings with the family or with individuals from the family, we may not get the whole picture of what's happening. In fact, we probably won't. And as the people that we're meeting with, the clients that we're working with become more comfortable with what's going on and they recognize that we are not going to push them into doing anything they're not ready to do or comfortable doing, they'll start to open up more and more about what's going on. One of the great things that's happened for us over the last year is that we are now co-located in a building with Mission Kids. So a lot of times someone will come into Laurel House and they'll come in to see us because of domestic abuse or domestic violence. And then as they're with us, they see Mission Kids sign across the hall and they think, maybe I need to talk to somebody about my kids too. And I know that Mission Kids has experienced the same kind of thing where somebody Absolutely. Will come in to see them and start asking about, well, maybe I should go over and talk to somebody from Laurel House too. So it's a great, we've been very fortunate to have this partnership.
Well, what Absolutely. Beth just described, telling a child that, oh, you'll be removed from the family. You might be placed in foster care or mommy or daddy will go away. Mm-hmm. So that's true of emotional abuse, if
Absolutely.
Ever I heard it. And
yep.
and that's just as traumatizing mm-hmm. as a punch.
Or more. Sure, yeah. absolutely. More so. Yeah. Emotional abuse is, and you have to remember, there's so much grooming involved in domestic violence cases as well as child abuse cases. And I think that's a huge similarity as well, where they are spending their time really trying to groom children, groom the adults in their life to say, you know, kind of say, I'm the safe person. They're picking vulnerable children to unfortunately exploit or abuse. But I think that is the, you know, common occurrence is this grooming behavior. We often have parents come into Mission Kids and are actually filling out an intake form. And when it says, are you feeling safe and comfortable at home? They're saying yes. And a few minutes later, they are realizing, yeah, maybe I do need to talk to somebody about Laurel House because it is really, and they're not identifying themselves as mm-hmm. domestic violence victims often because it is that control and isolation. And it certainly even months later, they still don't see it as an issue that they didn't have any money in their bank account or any availability to or access to money and didn't have their name on the home. There are these problems that unfortunately it's just been kind of grooming and they, in their minds, think that they didn't need those things.
Gosh, when you said the word grooming, I instantly, yeah. the hair on my backslide just came rankled, because those are the terms that they use when talking about sexual abuse or trafficking, et cetera.
Absolutely. But that's the truth of it. It certainly is grooming. It doesn't start out that someone is violent to a child or violent to an adult. It really is that grooming behavior, that isolation, that control, that absolutely, that cycle of something happening and then saying it was a mistake. I mean, it really is a grooming. It's absolutely what it is.
And I was going to ask about intergenerational abuse issues here. What happens to a child who grows up in a home where maybe if he or she isn't being abused, a sibling is, or watching mom or dad in an abusive relationship? What are the odds that this child is going to have normal relationships afterwards?
That's a great question, and I'm sure Beth has some thoughts on that as well. But we see that, unfortunately, boys and girls respond to experiencing as well as witnessing abuse differently. Oftentimes, boys, they have external type of response, meaning that you might see aggression or you might see acting out, these external responses. And with girls, we see kind of internal responses, them thinking it's their fault, kind of self-mutilation or suicidal ideation, where they kind of internalize it more, unfortunately. And so, yeah, I think it's really hard when their examples and role models don't kind of have healthy relationships. Yes, they're more likely to grow up and have unhealthy relationships.
What we see is just what Leslie just described, and what we hope and what we believe is that with early intervention, as quickly as possible, we can help to break that cycle so that the kids don't repeat it later, either as victims or as perpetrators or both. Sometimes people that are perpetrators of violence against each other as adults or against children started out as victims when they were kids. So what we hope and what our clinical team and our supportive services, part of what we're designed to do is to help break that cycle in the hopes that children won't repeat that in their adult life.
Well, what about children witnessing this in the home? And how do you mend a family? And how does a child ever have a healthy relationship with even the abused partner at this point, or the person who does not prevent abuse onto the child?
So one of the things that we've seen is that the majority of the people who come to us for help, the majority of the adults who have been victims of domestic abuse or domestic violence, when they come to us for help, typically what they want is just for it to stop. They typically don't start out wanting the relationship to be over. They want help to get the other person to stop being abusive. They want a healthier life for themselves and their kids. And they want, even once they may have made a decision to separate and break away from that relationship, they want to preserve the positive image of the other parent in their children's eyes, which takes a lot. What we try to do is to help that happen and help support that as much as possible, as long as it's safe for the child. And what we've seen, we have people that we work with now who lived in our shelter years ago as children, and who truly have been able to figure out ways of, with a lot of therapy and a lot of help, to have a healthy relationship with both the abused parent as well as the person that was the abuser. But it also requires the abuser to do some work to change, typically, for that to happen.
Can we talk about what happens when a family does come in? And now, Leslie, you talked about, you work with courts and
yes,
with law enforcement, et cetera. So you're seeing people brought in, and maybe a child has already been removed from the family. What does your work do? How does it operate, actually?
Yeah, certainly that's the last case scenario and things we want to avoid, because as Beth explained, that sometimes that's a threat. You'll go into foster care. You'll be taken away. That's certainly our last resort. And with that, certainly nothing that the child welfare system as well as law enforcement would want in most case scenarios. So I think early intervention, I think, is very powerful. And I think that with our law enforcement and the courts, I think they realize that as well. So assessing the situation and then also kind of starting to build resiliencies with that child. Mm-hmm. So one, kind of explaining that abuse and violence isn't okay. And sometimes for the abuser and the victim to explain that as well, that this wasn't healthy, that they make mistakes and adults make mistakes, and certainly listening to children and kind of having those really difficult conversations with children about what they've experienced, what they've witnessed, and why that wasn't okay for them, I think really is an important key to them growing up and having really healthy relationships.
Mm-hmm. And Beth, what happens when a family comes to you, and how do families get referred to Laurel House? Well, actually, it's usually women coming in. Why I just said that.
It's usually women, but we do serve male victims of domestic abuse as well. And we have served men who have children and who have custody of their children, men who have been abused by their significant other or their wife. So typically, families come to us in a variety of ways. We do have a hotline. It's 1-800-642-3150. We do have a website. People sometimes will just Google domestic violence, domestic abuse, and that'll come up as a local resource. There's a national hotline, so people who call the national hotline will be referred to local resources. We also receive a number of referrals, about 500 a year, from police and hospitals and medical personnel. And for those referrals, we have a amazing group of staff and 14 volunteers who are on call 24/7 and who go out to meet directly with the victim and any kids involved right there on the spot or at the hospital if there's someone brought into the hospital with suspicious injury.
You're listening to Our Delaware Valley. I'm Laura Lewis, and with us today from Laurel House, we have its executive director, Beth Sturman. If you'd like to find out more information about what they do, how you can get involved, or if you are looking for help, it is laurel-house.org. That's laurel-house.org. They have a toll-free hotline number that Beth just mentioned, 1-800-642-3150. That's 800-642-3150. And from Mission Kids Child Advocacy Center, we have Leslie Slingsby, its executive director. Find them at missionkidscac.org. That's missionkidscac.org. Or call them 484-687-2990. You have at your websites, you have a lot of information, of course, and we're going to cover that as we get to the very end here. But now we've talked about trauma. We've alluded to trauma. We've talked about what happens to a family when you have domestic abuse in the family. But what are the long-term effects on children? Children who don't escape or don't resolve these traumas. What's the outcome for them and their future going to look like?
Yeah, trauma, unfortunately, we know that has ramifications throughout the child's lifetime. And I think for a long time, we thought that they were just kind of emotional or psychological. I think we've had a lot of research that now shows they're also physical as well. And so, unfortunately, it certainly could be obesity to heart disease to an earlier death, all related to trauma in childhood. And so it's really important for that kind of intervention to take place earlier so that we can avoid certainly some of the long-term emotional, psychological, which could be certainly anxiety, depression, suicide, drug and alcohol abuse, all related, unfortunately, to a childhood trauma. We also see a lot of kids who experience childhood trauma entering the criminal justice system in a higher correlation. And so there are very serious ramifications. Now, that's certainly not the case with all children. It certainly depends on the frequency as well as the severity of abuse or the abuse that they're witnessing. That would all take effect.
When you have counseling, obviously, what happens? How do you handle someone who walks in your door? And you have emergency shelter. So please do just give us a little bit more background on Laurel House.
So we do have an emergency shelter. That's how Laurel House started in 1980 as a shelter for battered women and their children. Over the years, as we started to recognize the need for other supportive services to go with that, our work expanded so that we now have counseling in 5 different locations throughout the county. One of them is a walk-in site. It's called Nicole's Place at Laurel House, and that's in Huntington Valley. We get a remarkable number of walk-ins. That site opened in the end of November of last year and immediately went from 6 counseling clients to 32 counseling clients, and the majority of those were just word of mouth. And the majority of those, we often have walk-ins coming directly into that center. So we think it's a great resource in the community for people to come in, pick up information about services, talk to a counselor about things they're concerned about, and start at least beginning to make decisions about how they want to proceed with getting some help. Our other locations are more private. We have a counseling location up in North Wales, one in Pottstown, one in East Norton, and one in Bryn Mawr. And we find in every community, no matter where we are, that people are eager for the help and both individual and support group counseling.
The term battered women.
Yes. It's an outdated term in some ways because for a number of reasons, as I said earlier, oftentimes women who have been abused don't identify as abuse victims because they don't feel, quote unquote, battered. They maybe have never had a black eye or a broken bone, but they may have been pushed, shoved, strangled, other things that don't necessarily leave marks, or they may have been, as Leslie talked about earlier, that financial abuse where they haven't had any access to the family finances. We've had, one of the reasons we found it necessary to expand our counseling to other communities was because people, which was a shock to me, but people find that their odometer on their car is being checked. So if they go too far from, if they say they're going to the grocery store and it looks like they've been, you know, a lot further away than the grocery store, the abuse will resume. So that kind of power and control makes it necessary for us to have services available. We'll meet people at a pizza place. We'll meet people at the Wawa. We'll meet people at wherever is convenient for them and wherever is safe for them so that we can begin to get them connected to services.
Leslie, is this what you see in child abuse as well? Is it so secretive? Is it so shameful, or I don't know how to describe it. What am I going for here?
Yeah, no, absolutely secretive, shameful. I think that we're getting better with that, but I do think there's a lot of guilt, shame, secrecy around child abuse still. And so, unfortunately, we know that most cases are not kind of disclosed right away. It takes certainly time for children to feel safe and find someone that they can talk about the abuse with that kind of triggers our system at Mission Kids, where it's reported. And then they would get information about coming to Mission Kids. They would come in for a forensic interview as well as all of these supportive services surrounding this child. But it certainly takes that initial disclosure or suspicion, someone saying, I am worried about this child, and kind of making that report. So it absolutely still has so much shame and secrecy surrounding abuse, unfortunately.
I was going to ask, who should pick up the phone and actually reach out to you? And yeah. I was going to ask about, and I know somebody has mentioned emergency services, and we've talked about, obviously, the courts already and police. Who should be reaching out to you? And to you, Beth, who should be picking up the phone and calling?
So it should be anyone who has a suspicion of child abuse. And while there's certain professionals who are and volunteers are considered mandated reporters, I think that everyone has a responsibility, an ethical responsibility, of if they have a suspicion of abuse, kind of making a child line report either online or through a toll-free phone number. But unfortunately, it won't come to Mission Kids until that report is made to Childline. And so when that report is made to Childline, then we can kind of put everything in place. But it does take that one person to recognize it and make that report, which is essential.
And you have the hotline posted on your website.
Absolutely, we do. Yep.
And Beth, what about family or friends or witnesses to to family issues?
One of the things that we have seen an increase in, which I'm really appreciative of because we see that it makes a big difference, is when family members who are concerned about a loved one that they think may be in an abusive relationship, when the family members call us and set up and come in and meet with one of our counselors, oftentimes because they need help themselves. It's so scary for them to think that their loved one is in an abusive relationship, and they want help to figure out, well, what they want help initially usually is to figure out how to rescue the person. But what we work with them on is how to be a supportive, safe person for that abused victim to come to, and leave the door open, because one of the things we know is that if you charge in and try to rescue the person, the door is probably going to shut tighter, and now you're not a person that they're going to go and confide in about what's really happening in the home anymore. So what we find is that when family come in, they meet with a counselor, they get some ideas about how to be supportive to their loved one, even though they're terrified about what may happen to the loved one, that over time, sometimes that approach really works to help eventually get the loved one that they've been concerned about into at least see a counselor and get started. And I just was with a young woman the other day, and her little girl, who's close to 2 years old and very full of energy. And I remember when her mom came to us, and she was terrified for her young daughter, who was about 20 at the time, who was in a really abusive, physically abusive relationship, and the mom wanted to charge in and rescue her. And our counselor was able to work with the mom and help her know that wasn't the right approach in terms of safety. And eventually, when the young lady ended up in the hospital, severely injured, she said to her mom, "I think I'm ready to call that number you've asked me to call." And she came in for counseling. We supported her through the whole court process with getting custody of the little one and going through all the different pieces that she needed to go through to get free from this abuse. And she's thriving. Her little girl's thriving. And it was just one of those things that makes makes it easier to get up and do it all over again the next day.
And Beth, don't you think that there is a something to that with parents being ready to come forward and get services because
Absolutely.
They want to protect their child? I think that's one of the beauties between partnering between a child advocacy center or any type of child welfare agency, to be completely honest with you, and domestic violence agencies. Because I think when a report is made and finally, you know, there's systems intervening, it feels really serious. There's child protective services, there's law enforcement, there's a district attorney. I think this is a time of contemplation for that victim of domestic violence kind of making a decision about change in services.
Absolutely. I think that that's a really good point. And I think that sometimes people often ask us, well, you know, once she, well, just for the sake of simplicity, once she, the victim, knows that this is hurting her kids, why doesn't she leave? And there are a lot of different reasons. And some of that involves the court system and the custody and knowing that if she does leave, that the abusive parent will probably have unsupervised visitation with those kids and she won't be there anymore as a buffer to help protect the kids and to be like a safe place for the kids to turn to. So I think it's great that we do have the partnership with Mission Kids, that we can work on these kinds of things together, and that we do have the work with the police departments and the court systems and the more work that we can do with courts around making sure that once a decision has been made to separate from the abusive significant other, especially if there are children involved, that that can be done in a way that's healthy for everybody, especially the kids.
Obviously, it takes money, it takes hours and people to do all of this work. Are you looking for people to work with you?
We are always looking for volunteers. One of the most important things that people can help us with is helping raise awareness, because as much work has been done in that area, this is still sometimes quote unquote a hidden issue, a silent epidemic. And so the more work that we can do with just getting the word out, we have a lot of different ways that volunteers can help with that.
Leslie, same?
Yeah, Mission Kids is always looking for volunteers and allies to absolutely get out in the community, talk about child abuse, talk about prevention efforts. There really are some easy prevention efforts, and we just need to kind of get the word out there to our allies in the community.
And, of course, there are also events coming up for Leslie. They have Night Out on November 10th, and that's at the Paddock Room at Mermaid Lake.
Yes.
Real quick, what will that be?
So it really will be a fun night of good food, good company, a DJ, dancing, raffles. And so we really just want people to come out, learn more about Mission Kids, and kind of celebrate all the successes we've had regarding child abuse and child abuse prevention in the past year.
And then, Beth, I know you have an annual 5K dash.
Every October.
But you've also got Gay Bingo coming up and one I've never heard of, the Pennsylvania Philharmonic Holiday Concert for Laurel House.
We're really excited about the partnership with the Philharmonic. Gay Bingo sold out within 3 hours after it opened. So if people want to come out to the Philharmonic concert, it's a holiday brass. It's at will be held at Rosemont College. It's a joint effort between the Philharmonic and Laurel House, including 50 seats that have been set aside for the families that we serve so that they can come at no cost and enjoy the afternoon. For the rest of the audience, it'd be great to have folks come out and support and also just have a fun, affordable afternoon with your kids and your family celebrating the holidays.
And, of course, because of your footprint, we know that if we go to your website, we're going to find out information about all the programming that you offer. We will find national hotlines if you're not in your service range that will help you find somebody who can refer you to the agency in your community. So don't worry about going there and thinking, I don't live near. Look them up. You will find national hotlines that will get you in touch with services in your community. And my guests today have been Beth Sturman, the executive director of Laurel House. Find them at laurel-house.org, a 24-hour hotline, 1-800-642-3150, but laurel-house.org online. And for Mission Kids Child Advocacy Center, go to missionkidscac.org. That's missionkidscac.org. Call them at 484-687-2990. And our guest from Mission Kids today, the executive director, Leslie Slingsby. And ladies, thank you for coming in today.
Thank you for having us, Laura.
It's been great.
You're always welcome back. I'm Laura Lewis. This has been our Delaware Valley.